Hello everyone, this is Hashim of Economics, or Hashim of Iqtisadiyyat, and I'm Behzad. Today we have a guest, Dr. Alice Evans. Welcome, Dr. Evans.
Thank you.
Let me start with your bio that you put on your LinkedIn. And there you write, "The great gender divergence marks our world. In South Asia and Middle East, most women remain secluded. Chinese women work, but are locked out of politics. Latin America has radically transformed, nearly achieving gender parity in political representation and massive rallies against, against male violence. Scandinavia still comes closest to the feminist utopia, but for most of history, Europe was far more patriarchal than matrilineal South Asia and Southern Africa." And I know I heard about it, that you're writing a book on this.
Yes.
So can you start telling us, how did you discover this topic and what you do here at Monk School and generally in your academic career?
Okay, thank you so much. So for the past 14 years, I've been studying gender. I started off doing ethnographic work in Zambia. I speak Bemba. I was living with different communities and studying gender relations over the past 100 years. Then I did comparative work on rural and urban areas, and I traveled to Cambodia studying gender. And then in 2019, I started reading economic history and all these phenomenal books about how the West became rich and democratic. And so people are asking, you know, why are some countries rich and democratic while others are poor or authoritarian? And I realized we could ask precisely the same globally comparative question about gender. Why are some countries very, very gender equal while some, like Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, remain much more patriarchal? Why is that? And I thought that was a big, exciting question that we ought to be able to answer. Now, until now, no one's ever tried to answer that question. We don't even have studies of gender explaining histories in one country, you know, like why, what. And so I thought, okay, this is a crazy task, but let me do it. So what I'm trying to do is study the history of every single country in the world over the past 4,000 years and try to explain what drives change over time, how the entire world has become more gender equal, and why some are more gender equal than others. That is the plan.
Okay, but I know you did your PhD in economic geography analysis.
In geography, right? Yes.
So how does your geographical education, do you think, shapes the questions that you ask?
To be honest, I don't really consider myself a geographer. I think I'm a social scientist.
Okay.
Like, I learned from economics, anthropology, sociology, political science, neuroscience, right? Why not harness all the tools in the books? If we're trying to explain humanity, we need everything we've got, right?
Yeah.
So no, I don't identify, my pronouns are social scientists.
I see. But what about your sort of academic appointments? Like, when you are working on a project, do you work on specific project when you come here to Toronto? Is there any specific thing you're studying or being in Toronto?
I'm very lucky that I have total freedom to do whatever I think is important. So I meander around.
Oh, that's really cool. So let me introduce you then a bit formally. As I understand, you did your PhD in economic geography, and now you are a lecturer, senior lecturer at King's College.
Yes.
In development studies.
Yes.
And then you teach development economics and gender issues.
So I just teach the political economy of development, like all about 20th century growth or lack of growth.
Okay. So the first question then, from your answer was, you know, you were inspired by the studies about how the West became rich
and so forth.
And you started asking questions why there is a gender disparity across nations. How is richness is correlated with that?
Yes, for sure. Definitely. So job-creating economic growth is a major engine of gender equality. So across the world, there is cultural variation in the extent to which communities value female seclusion or value housewives. In some societies, like Saudi Arabia, there is a very, very strong preference. In Thailand, Cambodia, there is a weak preference. But all societies, when there is job-creating economic growth, women flock into the labor force, but at different rates. And I explain this in terms of the honor-income trade-off. So even in conservative communities that value male honor and where male honor is contingent on female chastity, if job creating economic growth is high enough, if the female earnings are high enough, then it will compensate for men's loss of honor. So we observe this definitely in East Asia during the 1970s and more lately in China in the 1990s. So families cared about honor. They didn't, you know, a family would worsen their marriage prospects if people were gossiping about the girl, thinking she was up to no good. But there were so many factories. There was such rampant demand for labor that all the girls were going to the cities. And so it became normal, culturally expected, for women to go to work. That income overcame the loss of honor.
So how necessary is it to introduce honor in this equation? I was thinking about it in the following model. I was thinking about household production function, and then you have to have somebody doing household chores. And, you know, 80 years ago, for example, somebody has to boil the kettle and, yes, then, you know, bring water from the well and so on and so forth. So it requires quite a bit of labor to maintain the normal activities of the household, and the outside options, working in a factory or whatever, were not that lucrative.
Yes.
And so it made sense economically to the rational agents without any sort of non-rational things like honor and stuff that we introduced to this model. It would still make sense. Why do you think introducing things
absolutely
like...
Absolutely. Yeah. But even controlling for economic development, there are some countries where female labor force participation is far, far lower than what you'd expect.
Like East Asia right now?
No, so in South Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa, female labor force participation is very, very low compared to other countries with the exact same wealth. So, for example, let me give you an example. Turkey versus Mexico.
So
Turkey has a stronger preference for female seclusion compared to Mexico. So in Mexico, female labor force supply will rise far more rapidly. So the two countries have the exact same GDP per capita, but they differ culturally with a stronger preference for female seclusion. So you're totally right.
I see.
Totally right that if you have a huge volume of domestic work, if you do not have labor saving appliances like ovens, washing machines, microwaves, if you do not have contraceptives, you know, before the modern era, the adult woman would have spent 60% of her time either pregnant or nursing.
Yeah.
Right? She cannot leave.
That's right.
But there are many societies that have rapidly reduced their fertility, have access to labor saving appliances, but still women remain in their homes. Like India now has near replacement fertility, but
female... Less than two.
Yeah.
Like below replacement, actually.
So, but female labor force participation is only 20%.
So don't you think... it is because of the opportunity cost of staying at home is not that high?
So part of it is the massive joblessness. Part of it, absolutely.
Okay.
Right? That it's just earnings for a pittance. But in Southeast Asia, in Mexico, in much of sub-Saharan Africa, we see a very different cultural response to the exact same economic opportunities.
Okay. How do you think about this strain of literature in economics? I think Nathan Nunn and his co-authors wrote about... types of agriculture that people did like thousands of years ago.
Yes.
And how are like gender disparities maintain or show themselves today?
Yes.
What's your take on this strain, or the literature there?
So let me say a couple of points. So Esther Bosserup is the first economist that came up with the idea of the plow. So for the plow, you need a strong man. You're in the ground, right?
Like, upper body strength.
Yes, upper body strength. Yeah. And men typically have 2.5 times the upper body strength of women.
That's right.
So it made sense that men would be in the plow. And so she theorized that women would then be at home processing cereals like grounding maize, millet, etc. And that would naturalize domesticity, and it would also encourage female subordination. That's the theory. And then Alessina, et cetera, Nunn, they test this empirically and they show there's this correlation.
Oh, okay.
But
so they're first to do it.
The first to do it is Esther Bosserup. Theorist is Esther Bosserup. Okay. Then they test it empirically. The problem with this theory is that even if women are in the domestic arena, that doesn't necessarily imply a cult of seclusion. And it's the cult of seclusion that mediates women's responsiveness to economic opportunities. So, for example, the Inuit culture, men would go off hunting. Men were in the public domain. They would, you know, hunt otters, seals, whales, right? Women would stay at home looking after their children and making the skin. So they would chew the caribou skins. So women were in the igloos, right? So that is domesticity. But they never had a cult of seclusion. Women could be musicians, women could be dancing. When you had job opportunities in the 1970s, 1980s, women seized them. So just because you have this idea of women doing that housework, it doesn't necessarily mean that the community will idealize chastity and seclusion, the honor code.
So I think there's one paper, it's still working paper, and I'm blanking on author's name, but her main finding was that the attitudes towards promiscuity in mostly African societies is correlated with how much men spend time at home. And if men do jobs that are...
maybe you mean Anke Becker's paper. So Anke Becker has a paper on pastoralism.
Yeah.
So, and this is a great topic for you and I to discuss. Okay. So pastoral communities, in some pastoral communities, for example, like Sardinia or maybe Somalia, the man goes away with his herd himself.
Yep.
And then there is what you might call an information asymmetry to be an economist, right? And he's like, what is my wife up to?
So
that insecurity might motivate infibulation, circumcision, etc. Okay, let me say there are three problems with this. One, like the Nathan...
Let me interrupt you for a second. I have heard this story anecdotally from people who are very not familiar with the economics literature on gender promiscuity. From like a random chats with like an Afghan drivers, and they were saying that they were talking about Afghanistan and their attitudes towards women in different regions, and non-Pashto person was talking about Pashto people being that, and then I don't want to use the word theorizing, but his explanation was that, and I was like, oh my God, there's actual literature on this, but I didn't like sort of
okay, well
like,
let's consider a couple of societies. Okay, one thing that we need to be careful of. A lot of economic historians, they like to look at the Murdoch, the ethnographic atlas. The problem with this is data from maybe the 1800s, 1900s, that omits massive cultural evolution over millennia, right? So, you know, you can have a rise and fall in patriarchy, and if you just look at that cross-sectional data, you might think that it's geography that determines things, but it's not. Culture has changed massively over time. You know, in the exact same geography, Egyptian women in ancient Egypt, they were not veiled, they were musicians, they were priestesses, cults. So there's a lot of cultural variation, which is why I personally want to study change over time. Okay, so that's one point. Second point is that actually pastoral nomads vary a lot. So if we take the Kazakhs, for example, right? This is not an information asymmetry. One, because it's not the one man moving by himself.
It's the whole
tribe. It is the entire tribe family moving together. And you also have variations. But that again, that itself is not determinist, because Arab nomads would also move the whole tribe moving together.
But the attitude towards gender is
totally different. Yeah. It's totally different. Yeah. So you have enormous, or we go back to the Inuits. I gave the example before. These were hunters. You know, when you go and hunt in your whale, it could be men away for a very long time.
That's why I brought it up. I was like, the whales should have the same attitude as Somali.
Exactly. Yeah. So another example would be Amazigh in the mountains. You know, those pastoral nomads, the entire family would move to the summer camp higher up in the hills. But the Kazakh women were not veiled. Women were musicians, women were dancers, women would gather in the local assemblies. Women might also play diplomatic roles. So in the court of Genghis Khan, for example, for the Mongols, also Turkic people, women were represented in the courts, women were diplomatic agents, women had status. And interestingly, there are many burials of women warriors across the Central Asian steppe. And these women, you know, because on horseback, you can be just as fast as a man. So you're eliminating that upper body strength advantage. Also using the recursive bow, which was very light. A woman could be fast and nimble. She could have a hound. She could have a hawk or an eagle and train it to help her with hunts. So horses could kind of eliminate that biological superiority of men. So I think really...
So like technology basically kind of equates...
Technology creates a lot of variation. So I think that... But I don't think we can reduce it all to technology. I think that Central Asian Turkic people were just much more gender equal.
Than Persianates?
Than Arabs, absolutely.
Not Arabs, but in Central Asia, there were Persianates, Persian-speaking people. Versus,
So if we go back to the Ogon inscriptions, it says the Khan and the Khatun decree, the Kenyan and the Queen decree. So if we look at those epic ballads, they're all like praising these women warriors. So there is far greater respect and reverence for women. And I just think that is a cultural innovation. So I think sometimes we've got to recognize cultural diversity, and that can ebb and flow over time. So for example, when Ibn Battuta went to what is now Turkey, Anatolia, in the 12th century, or was it 14th century, either 14th or 13th century, he observed these women were not veiling, they did not, they drank alcohol, he said these women are very free, one woman scratched her vagina in front of him, and he was an Arab, so he was pretty surprised by that. So I just think the Turkic people had very different cultural norms. And I don't
think... exactly in Anatolia he went to?
I forget.
Like, because, you know, Anatolia has difference in... type of people, like they were like Greeks, Armenians.
Yes. But these were Turks,
right?
These were Turkic peoples. But they assimilated because of their engagement with the Abbasids, and they adopted Islam. So if you look, if you go to Konya today, I was in Konya last year, you can see all these Seljuk ceramics where women are shown like as musicians. They're not veiled. They're quite prominent in public places, and I think that just culturally changed after the influences of people like Ghazali and other Persian theologians who said that female seclusion was part of male piety.
Ah, I see. Okay. So let me introduce one more variable to your construction. Again, very sort of anecdotally. People talk about landscape and terrain. At least in some findings, they say it matters for things like aggressiveness, for example. And the theory goes, and I'm not sure it's...
Oh, this is the Nathan Nunn paper on herding and violence?
Yeah. But there's earlier work by a couple of like Soviet anthropologists, where they were trying to describe why in Soviet army, people from Caucasus are more aggressive or something. And their theory was kind of in a similar fashion. It was like, you know, in mountainous regions, your crops or like your wealth could be taken away in a heartbeat, right? Like Nathan Nunn sort of argument. And because of that, you have to maintain this aura of aggressiveness.
Tough. I'm so tough, you are.
Exactly,
aggressive.
Yeah.
You don't want to damage.
But then in the same Caucasus, like if you go down the mountains, you know, people used to do agriculture in which the fruits of labor cannot be taken away as easily. And that's why, you know, just being tough for the sake of it didn't make sort of an evolutionary sense in some way. So if we take this aggression as a different variable, attitudes towards women's role, how would that change? Do you think this is correlated?
So the Cao and Nunn paper and others, so they show that herding is associated with one, contemporary conflicts, and also folklore tends to celebrate violence.
That's right, yeah.
And so their theory is that I don't think it's so much about mountains, but about the insecurity of their assets and the lack of law and order, right? So it is very difficult to build a strong state if you have nomads who can move about because they can't pay taxes, you can't impose any kind of law and order. And if you have no law and order, if you have no legal protection from the police, from the courts, then you need to act tough. In fact, we see this if we look back at the legal record in England. So in the 16th
century... Like Scottish people.
Yeah, no, I can talk to you a lot about Scotland. Now, Scotland is a very interesting case. We should talk about this. Okay. So the Highland tribes were violent, warmongers, right? Super tough, super... these are nomads. These are herders. But they didn't seclude women. So how did you then get the Scottish Enlightenment? How did you then get these norms of civility? Yeah. Right, so here is my theory.
Okay,
first of all, you have massive violent repression. So the English come in and they totally decimate the Highland tribes. They force them to hand over their weapons. They force them to give up their kilts and their tribal allegiance.
But
there is a quote, you mentioned Afghanistan. Walter Scott said the Highland tribes are just like Afghanistan, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so first of all, you have the violent repression, stamping them out. And then you get to religion. So you have these very, very draconian Kirk sessions. And they are instilling norms like, you know, you need to be hardworking, you need to not drink alcohol, you need to be very abstemious, you need to do the right thing. So they're trying to build this culture. Then we also see in the emerging centers of Edinburgh, stronger state development. So Adam Smith writes about this, about how one, courts would penalize violence, and two, people gained confidence in the courts. So it's not just that there is, say, a $5 or $50 fine for violence, but people expected the courts to create the rule of law. So for example, previously, if you budged me in the street, let's suppose both men, I might challenge you to a duel, right? Yep. Because you would slight in my honor. I'm like, you want to bring it? Let's bring it. Let's fight, right? Yeah. But then I think actually the courts are going to do a better job of all this. There's no need for me to risk my life. So it's confidence in law and order. Another thing is these enlightenment clubs culturally celebrated politeness. So for example, you had a bunch of enlightenment clubs, like, you know, for literature, for science, and they had all these norms like, you may only speak when you raise your hand. And this was all celebrated in the newspapers because you had all these upwardly mobile people saying, you know, the polite person, the gentrified person raises
his
hand.
That's how they should behave.
Yes, this is what a modern man of Scotland does. On top of that, in places like Inverness, you have the emergence of a commercial middle class. And these are people who care about law and order. These are merchants, factory owners, who want businesses to thrive. So when a bunch of Highland louts come in, being violent, being, you know, consuming alcohol, they call in the police because these people are causing a mess for their business. So you've got people with a vested economic interest in law and order. So I think it's the conflict. So that's a sort of big story. It's, you know, it's a bunch of variables. It's got violent repression of the Highland clans, the emergence of economic growth, and also Christianity with these rules of propriety accelerated by the Enlightenment club. So it's both a bit of conflict, it's violence, and it's economics. That would be my Scotland story.
I see. Okay. And so the difference between, say, Sicily and Scotland would be the law and order.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So Sicily had a very high homicide rate until very recently.
Until very recently, yeah, that's what I was saying. So,
and every man had to act tough.
Exactly, yeah. If you don't, then you like...
People would take advantage. Yeah. In Zambia, where I used to live, they said the ukulia amusukwe pamutwe, which means to eat a piece of fruit from the person's head. So, you know, African women might carry a plate of food on there. It'd be like someone just taking that from you, like someone taking advantage of you. You know, if you act soft, then people will just take whatever they can.
Do you know how Uzbeks say a soft acting man?
Like, uh-huh, what is it?
It's a guy who cannot take a piece of wood out of a sheep's mouth.
That's like, a good one. Yes, a real softy, useless man.
Really softy,
useless man.
But see, like, even I think, like, within regionally, like, if you go to Caucasus and so on, like, people in the north think that people who are in the cities are like softies, right?
Yes.
And their logic wasn't explicitly that, but they say, like, you know, you gotta have this aura of aggression, not necessarily use violence, but like being able to use, I think is more of it.
Yes.
And so if you look at the violence numbers, it's a bit misleading thing. It could be that in this Sicily type of places, homicide rates, you said it's high, right? So Sicily is not a great example, but like just imagine a society where there's a low homicide rates, kind of, but it's enforced because everybody has this sort of nuclear bomb sort of thing. Like everybody's is a tough man, so you can't really do homicides. And the not tough ones are sort of selected out, and it's really hard to do empirical work in that sort of.
Another important thing can be that specific cultures can be celebrated. So you gave the example of the proverb, the saying, right? Also, if you look at Mexico today, right, there crime is thriving, and there is also a set of music that celebrates these violent macho men. Right, there's actually one mayor in Mexico who said they're not allowed to have misogyny in their music. But you know, all those kinds of things can be culturally celebrated. And you know, or a clan, for example, might sing their own praises by talking about their conquest, talking about how victorious they were in battle. So it's all like, well, for example, a father might say to a son who is crying, "Are you a man or a mouse?" Right. Yeah, so we are socialized to be tough, men especially.
In most places, like even in sort of places like Russia, which is, I would say, quite developed in many social aspects, like crying is not a manly thing
to
do, right?
And that's all part of like the cult of war, the cult of masculinity. You know, to be a real Russian man, you've got to be able to fight a beast. You know, you see all those videos of men uploading on YouTube of, look, this is me, you know, sitting on a bear, a black bear or something, right? They want to show how tough they are. And, you know, that could be accelerated, for example, in the 1990s when you had the rise of urban street crime and you really needed to signal how tough you were.
In the modern world, like when you travel, like you've been to many places, where do you observe the most gender dimorphism is like the difference between genders in the world. Where is the most that you
in
see?
In terms of places that I've been, I think one good example would be I was in villages in Bihar last year. So their rate of female employment is 5%. And that's in cities, in Patna. And if I go to the villages, I was in four villages in Bihar, and the women were very shy and they would cover their faces. And they would not speak so much. And I was chatting to many of the women. I said, you know, has a woman ever left this village to go for work? And they said they'd never heard of it. So in India, it's very common for women to migrate for marriage, but it's men who would go to places like Dharavi and Mumbai to get work. Another example, when I was in Rajasthan, when I went to villages there, the women did not even come out of their homes. So it was men who came to greet us. So it's a totally, and so I would chat with women in the homes, you know, cross-legged on their beds, right? But yes, that is a very, very different. And I want to go to Pakistan next year. So again, that, you know, in Pakistan, there are some villages where since the 1960s, women have not voted.
I see.
In some Pakistani villages, I was reading on the internet, and that is because...
Isn't it like a tribal territory in the northwest?
It is because... I want to come back to your point on northwest Pakistan. Yeah. So going back to your point about ruggedness can enable cultural isolation. So in northern Pakistan, there are three valleys where the Kalash people live. They are not Muslim. They are polytheistic. Women do not veil. They wear brightly colored dresses and they're far more autonomous and have higher status. So that is one good example of where a conquering force might be very patriarchal, and that is how culture spreads. So it's not determined by geography. It's not determined by anything in that terrain. You have this conquering force and then you have cultural assimilation. The same occurred in the Amazigh Mountains in Morocco. Cultural isolation. They also had linguistic isolation in the Atlas Mountains.
They speak very different. They don't speak Arabic.
They speak Amazigh. Up until the 1990s, 65% of Moroccans were speaking Amazigh. That is linguistic cultural isolation because of rugged terrain.
Like Berbers in Algeria, right?
Yeah. So Amazigh is another word for Berbers, yes. And there was a Berber woman in Algeria who led men against the colonial French.
I was about to say that.
No point interviewing me. You know the answers already.
I'm curious about stuff. Like, I'm really curious because I don't like, whenever I think about gender differences, like, it seems like I never catch like what's going on. It's like, whatever theory I have, I can give you 20 counterexamples on my own, right? So it's really hard to
hypothesize. But I think it's because, economists like to test the causal effect of one particular variable.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Whereas me, as someone who studies 4,000 years of human history, I see that all these things come into play together and they're all they're built, it's like building a rope, right? There are many threads to it and they all lace on top of each other.
Let's talk about specific culture. Let's say my recent readings was, I think Yanagizawa Drott, he wrote the paper on gender attitudes of husbands towards female employment in Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
You read the paper.
And he's got a more recent paper.
On?
The same thing, misperceived norms.
I think that's the paper I'm talking about.
Yes.
So basically, like, the survey was, and fill me in if I'm not right, was that when he asked men about, what do you think of your wife working? They were not very enthusiastic about it. Let me just put it mildly.
Yes, yes.
They were fine with it. But then when the question was like, what do you think the society would think if your wife would work? The men were like, no, society wouldn't accept it. I mean, it's sort of a preference falsification a little bit, right? Like
pluralistic ignorance, right, absolutely. So this is why I theorize there are several dimensions of gender norms. One is my internalized ideologies. Like what I personally believe is right and wrong.
Okay.
Like, for example, this can be like, I think it's perfectly fine for women to be leaders. I think women can be great at maths. I think women can do a bunch of stuff. But I may nonetheless be reluctant to pursue that because I anticipate social disapproval, right?
Yes.
So it is the anticipation of the social penalty, which could risk a bunch of things. It could be ostracism from my tribe. It could be other people looking down on me. It could harm my
daughter. Like a decrease of status or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, and so, for example, if you're in a tight kinship community, you really care about that gossip because you don't want to be alienated.
Exactly.
You know, if you're in India and you rely on your jati to look after you during the monsoon, you don't want everyone to think that you're a terrible person with a loose daughter, right?
Yeah.
So these misperceived norms really matter. So there's, after the study in Saudi Arabia, they've actually done a global study with Gallup.
On the same thing?
Yes, oh, wow. Exactly on the same thing, on misperceived norms. They asked both about women working outside the home and also affirmative action. And what they find in many countries, in Latin America and also India, but not Pakistan, that people underestimate support for women working.
So let me then ask you the opposite. Yes. Are there societies in which people...
correctly get it, yes.
No, not correctly, but the opposite, meaning like...
they overestimate.
No. Let's say, are there societies... like in Saudi Arabia, people think...
underestimate,
the society is more conservative than they are.
Yes.
But like, I don't know, in the US or Scandinavia, isn't it the opposite? Like,
So they asked a question on affirmative action and they find that Americans overestimate wider support for affirmative action.
Oh, I see.
They think people are more progressive than they really are.
No, but what I really care about is like, it's the personal attitude versus the societal attitude.
Yes.
Like meaning, you know, let's say, I don't know, 5% of American men don't want their wife to be working, but 99% believe.
There's no society, as far as I'm aware, where people overestimate wider support for women working. But there are societies where people overestimate support for women in politics.
I see. Okay. So in the same kind of idea, what do you think how corrections from institutions like the state can create lasting cultural norms or not? One of the examples I heard, I think you know very well, like in Turkey, after Ataturk, there was this program to bring women from villages into the city universities. It was specifically targeted for women. They had the quotas and so on. So many women were able to go to the best institutions in the country, like, you know, Boğaziçi or Middle East, like Otu and so forth. And people say like that was one of the reasons why Turkish gender norms are...
I don't buy it. Turkey has had very, very low job creation. Right? That is the main issue in Turkey. So even though Ataturk introduced a number of secular laws, and even though Ataturk brought all the madrasas and mosques under state control, the problem was low economic growth.
Yeah.
Right? And it doesn't matter if women get educated. If there aren't the jobs there, then there isn't the income to compensate for the lack of honor. So women stay at home.
I see.
So you have in across the Middle East, especially in the Arabian Gulf, you have gender parity in education.
Yeah.
Right? India has also got gender parity in education in Christianity, but it's not enough.
It's the opposite now, right? Like I was looking in the Middle East numbers. If you look at the STEM fields, there are a lot more women in STEM fields in like Jordan than in like
Jordan has a high share of women in STEM fields in education.
No, in education.
Jordan has a very, very low rate of female labor force participation. I think it's below 20%.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, I looked at the countries that have high rates of women studying STEM.
Yes.
And it's kind of negatively correlated with female labor. Like, Norway has...
Low, yes.
Very,
there aren't many
very
women
few
in STEM,
women
yes, yes.
studying in, like, Norway. Like, Scandinavia is the worst. Like,
yes.
I mean, four times worse than North Africa.
Yeah.
Or something like that. It's a ridiculous... So if you like plot it, I mean, I didn't. I was like just Googling stuff. You know, you would see that the more the women work in a country, the less of them would want to study in a STEM
field.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know, to be honest. I think there are a number of possibilities. One, for example, might be that girls tend to be more likely to pursue STEM if they're in single-sex schools. And many Middle Eastern countries have single-sex schools. So that's one possible explanation. Another possibility is it really depends on the size of the local labor demand. So there are just some countries where STEM may have more jobs than others. So for example, India is the world number one for higher share of female pilots, right?
So even though it has
very low female labor force participation, its domestic aviation industry is massive. So there's a stronger labor demand, so women can go into that. So there are a bunch of variables, and I wouldn't comment on the global trend. What I do is look at each specific country and work out what's going on.
Oh yeah, so the question number two was like, what do you think about quotas and programs like affirmative action in modern societies, in achieving goals like gender equality and so forth? So like a lot of governments, especially the enlightened ones or those that claim to be enlightened ones, think about this problem that they perceive, oh, low labor force participation for females. And we're going to cure it, they think, with quotas, like, oh, like 30% of females should be represented in the parliament, or 20% should be in the government, or so forth. Do you think it is net positive or net negative?
And okay, let me make the positive case for quotas and then the negative case.
Okay, right. That's right.
So on the one hand, people develop their gender ideologies by observing the world around them, both their internalized ideologies and also their expectations of what they think other people support. So if I only ever see men in government, I may revere men as naturally better leaders. Moreover, I may anticipate discrimination. I think no one in my society wants women leaders, so I'm not going to put myself forward. So what you could have, therefore, is the lack of exposure to women reinforcing a negative feedback loop where other women don't put themselves forward. Moreover, if all those gatekeepers are men, they may remain very sexist. So for example, in Russia today, they're like the Duma is like almost 90% male, all the gatekeepers male, massive discrimination. People continue to think of leaders as masculine, right? Okay. So you might think that if we have quotas, then we're creating exogenous shock, we're increasing exposure to women in positions of prominence, and that might shift people's gender beliefs. Let me give a couple of reasons why we might question that. For example, most Latin American countries have seen a massive increase in affirmative action as a result of feminist mobilization. Brazil has not, however, and I'm not precisely sure why. It must be some institutional dynamic. No, I don't think it's religion. It could, no, I mean, it would be the evangelical stuff. I don't know precisely why. But if you look at World Value Survey data, if you look at employment data, all their other gender indicators are the same, right? So the fact that it, I think for some party institutional reasons, it doesn't have a quota, it doesn't have women in position, many women in positions of power. But in all the other respects, you don't see a big difference. The second thing I would raise is that the Western international community has, since the 1990s, pushed for gender quotas. It says women need to have a seat at the table, right? And aid-dependent authoritarians have often adopted quotas in order to signal their liberal democratic credentials in order to secure finance from the international financial institutions. And what this has caused, I would say, this is what Matt Andrews and Lauren Pritchett and Michael Wilcott called isomorphic mimicry, in that you're just projecting this signal of being very inclusive, but in fact, on the ground, actually nothing may change. Because one, if these countries are authoritarian, you have a powerful executive and the legislature has no power.
Yeah, secondly, like the Russian Duma, it doesn't matter if it's 90%
exactly. Second issue is in many African countries, you have very, very weak state capacity.
So and it you doesn't have, matter there as well.
And you have very, very high informality in the labor market. So even if you have more women legislators, you know, in Cameroon, for example, that or in Bissau, whatever, they're introducing legislation on gender-based violence. The World Bank has a massive program at the moment called Women, Business and Law, where they're trying to push for more gender-equal laws. But what effect does that have if 80% of people work in the informal economy? What effect does that have if the state capacity is so terrible? Let me give you an example. So I mentioned that 14 years ago, I did research in Zambia. The other day via Instagram, someone alerted me that a woman who I'd spent time with heard her husband had left her, right? So she was in a terrible economic situation. She'd left her house. She'd lost everything. So of course, I wanted to help her economically. But just getting the money to her was an enormous hurdle. What I needed to do is organize for someone else to go to Lusaka by coach, then go back to the village by coach. And that is not just one coach journey. Wow. It's like getting to the town, then getting your taxi. I had to orchestrate this enormous train just to transfer money.
Wow.
Right? So, you know, West State, you know, over at Yale, Mushfiq Mubarak was working on the COVID response. You know, just getting drugs to African villages where you have low population density, low state capacity, or give the example of India. India has many, many laws against dowry, against gender-based violence. on female inheritance, but women rarely claim those rights. So if women are still dependent on patriarchal guardians, if you still have very low female labor force participation, all those fantastic gender equal laws on paper just don't get claimed. So women don't report to the police because the police is overburdened. There are millions of murderers awaiting trial, lots of murderers, lots of rapists awaiting trial because the criminal justice system is overburdened. So legislators are never going to be very powerful in a place that either has a strong executive, high informality, or weak state capacity.
And bad economics.
Yeah, exactly. Which recreates this low female labor force participation. So, for example, I was talking to a colleague here at the University of Toronto, Carolina Artiga. She's doing work on domestic violence courts in Puerto Rico. You know, special courts just for domestic violence.
But
if people don't trust your criminal justice system,
it doesn't really matter then.
Makes no difference. Right? So as long as people don't trust your criminal justice system, Mexico may have a female president, right, after the upcoming elections. I was in Mexico and I was attacked. You know, a guy attacked me, whatever. I was punched in the face. Yes, we can jump over it. I called the police. What do they do? Right? Police does nothing.
Yeah, I mean, this is really sad, but a lot of times when I talk about this issue in Uzbekistan, for example, women who get harassed or something, like something bad happens, like a relative touches them or whatever, they are afraid to report it to anybody,
yes,
to any living soul, including the state, or like school authorities, if it happens in the university or school and so on. And so it's kind of like the existence of the law doesn't mean it is going to be...
There are lots of laws that are never claimed or enforced. And if you have stigma, if you have shame, if the vast majority of women are dependent on patriarchal guardians, if you still have a culture of honor and chastity, then a woman would be blamed. You know, across Eastern Europe, across Russia, their Eurostat surveys suggest that, you know, if a woman who is raped, you know, what was she doing? What was she wearing?
Exactly, yeah.
All those things which are victim blaming, right?
Yeah. I was reading... I think you're familiar with it. In Egypt, they did this survey asking privately women, were you ever like sexual harassed? And like almost like 100% said yes. Mm-hmm. And then almost everybody said they never reported to their male relatives. I'm not talking about like state authorities, like not even their closest kin. And that perpetuates the crimes. So the criminals are aware of this.
Total impunity. The perpetrators anticipate impunity.
Yeah.
Perpetrators know
they'll
get away.
They know that nobody's going to report it, and so they can continue doing it.
Do it, absolutely. And so, for example, I interviewed women who told me about when riding the bus as schoolgirls. They're very high risk of being molested.
Yes.
But some of them may not even want to tell their parents because then their parents might restrict their mobility further.
Yes.
So there are a bunch of reasons. Either, you know, you might be blamed. Either you worry that you're going to be restricted even more.
What were you wearing?
Yes, exactly. So it's very difficult. I mean, some societies, you do have feminists organizing against it. So in South Korea, there was massive organization for Me Too and they pushed for, you know, the click sound on cameras because men were doing upskirt photography and so now there was that click sound.
Yeah,
right?
it's a must, right?
It's legally mandated. But still, you know, whereas, you know, an institution's matter too because China is very authoritarian and it gives men total impunity for not just sexual harassment but also gender-based violence. So there's this wonderful new book by Tian Zhang which is all about police turning a blind eye to, you know, legally, a man can beat his wife to a pulp as long as it's not too often. And, you know, even if a wife complains to the police, they'll do nothing. They'll say, go away.
So in some way, this authoritarianism makes women's life especially horrid, right?
Well, I would say that authoritarianism prevents civil society in general and prevents feminist mobilization. And feminist mobilization is a major mechanism of cultural change. Of course, not every woman goes on a protest or a march, but you hear these ideas in magazines or newspapers.
But why? What I don't understand is, like, I was thinking about, so the political science of that, right? And, you know, in some way, isn't it like the blessing for authoritarian leaders if they have feminist movements? Because if they do have it, it kind of distracts them from other things. Because, you know, I'm not sure it is very commonly known in the West, but like first protests in the Soviet Union were ecological, people were protesting against ecology and so on because they couldn't protest against the party. And so, I mean, the theory of maybe it could be like, you know, the ecology protests actually collapsed the union. I don't know. But the point is, the women's rights is such an adjacent issue for many, like I have no explanation why in China it is the case or in Russia it is the case, because it doesn't seem to me the authoritarian leaders have any incentives to do that.
Because they want to... So in China and in Russia, civil society in general is repressed.
That's right.
So you don't have a culture of resistance. You don't have people believing that I can take to the streets, I can have a demonstration, or maybe we could change the law.
No, but
people
like,
will be much more despondent. And like, that feeds into everything.
But what about the property crime? Let's say if somebody steals something in China, police will be on it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course. They want to maintain law and order.
Yeah, so why don't they want to maintain law and order when it comes to women's rights?
Because the gender issue has not been politicized, right? People need to think of gender, you know, women need to identify collectively.
So the law and order is sort of a demand from society in the social contract. It's like, we're not going to vote, but you give us law and order.
Yes.
But in that law and order package, there is no piece of it that says
that women's lives matter
too. Be able to walk in the streets without being harassed and so on. Okay, I see. So there is no like sort of societal.
So people are not necessarily feminists. You know, even if women work at high rates, they may not necessarily prioritize their gender interests. And we see this in many African countries too. For example, I was recently chatting to a woman from Cameroon, and I also have friends in Nigeria. Their primary form of identity, loyalty, and allegiance is to their ethnic group. Like someone is Ibu, for example. They do not identify with a woman just because she is another woman. So a Hausa woman is totally different. She is a woman from the Muslim north.
Yeah.
She is totally different from an Ibo woman who loves. So the Ibo women will not necessarily take kindly to a campaign for gender quotas. Why would you want a Hausa woman? Right? What is that?
Yeah,
it's a totally different culture. So there's no natural affinity or sorority between women just because they are women. It's taken, you know, over 100 years of feminist campaigning to point to some of the structural oppression, and women iteratively mobilize against that in cultures where there is already a culture of resistance. So Latin America over the 1970s, over the 1980s had massive demonstrations against dictatorships. Over the 1990s, there were gas wars, there were water wars, there were the campaign of the Picoteros, the unemployed in Argentina. All this builds a culture that people can change the system, change the culture through mobilization. You know, that builds a sense of, like, going back to the point about pluralistic ignorance, this builds a sense of collective efficacy, that we can change it. It builds an idea of
can-do attitude,
rights and entitlement, but through mobilization specifically.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that can be accelerated by encuentros, so regional meetings, social media, sharing memes, etc. But in a culture like Turkey, so for example, I was in Istanbul last year, and my Iranian friends wanted to go to a protest against the Islamic Republic. Right? This is about the time of Masha Amini's, you know, protest for women, life, freedom. So they were going to go for the women, life, freedom protest. And they said, Alice, come. So of course I went. And she was like, Alice, you're wearing good shoes. I was like, yes. Yes. She says, Alice, if I say run, you run. And I told some of my Turkish friends I was going to the protest. And they were like, that is not a good idea. Do not go to the protest. And in fact, in Ankara, people were beaten up at that protest. So their expectations were a little bit right. So they're thinking, you know, they weren't thinking as feminists. They weren't thinking about gender. They were totally, you know, these guys weren't in favor of the Islamic Republic, right? But if you're in a culture whereby you've seen authoritarian repression, which is happening now in Turkey, you know, then you just don't go to protests. Don't do it. It's not worth it. Better just to stay home and adopt your own individual coping strategies.
Yeah.
But whereas in Latin America, women really, a lot of women, not all, you know, it's probably only 2% or something, but that sends a big signal in it. And, you know, women share all these TikToks, etc., and they have the same anthem, the same chant.
So many authoritarian places, I'm sure it happened in China and North Korea and Soviet Union, they basically forced women to work. So how this effect changed the attitude?
Okay, so I would say, so in some places there was forced labor. So for example, in parts of...
But by force, I don't mean
necessarily...
Yeah,
okay,
like,
but I want to talk about the economics
about
in some places there was forced collectivization, sedentary farming in parts of Tajikistan, for example.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it operated slightly differently, I think, through economics. So central planners set productivity targets high. So firms had to reach their productivity targets. They also set wages very low.
That's right.
So a male breadwinner could not single-handedly provide for his family. You needed two earners. Moreover, the workbook was like your passport to a bunch of other things, like maybe a holiday, maybe an apartment, whatever. So as a result of this, you had very high female labor force participation. Added to that...
Like in Uzbekistan, it was really high.
Yeah, added to that would, of course, be in Russia, whereby 40 million men died after the Second World War. So you had a massive labor shortage. So the Soviet firms always had a labor shortage because they wanted to meet their productivity targets, and it was easy. And so as a result of that, the vast majority of women would work full-time in Russia and in China and in Central Asia. But, you know, but they still tended to be very misogynist, sexist, but women...
So I don't understand why this is happening, though. Yeah. Like, if women work, why the misogynistic sort of thing?
Why does misogyny persist? Because it's not unusual for women to work. Women have worked all over the world throughout history. But the question is that work valued? Is that work respected? So even, you know, going back to our discussions on being domestic... In many parts of the world, domestic labor just isn't valued. Even though men and women are interdependent, even though a woman is playing a crucial role, looking after the children, making sure everyone is safe, making sure the food isn't poisoned, walking 10 kilometers to get that fire. She is working, right? The question is not the labor, but the question is that valued? Is that respected? And do women come to privilege their freedoms, their autonomy over a bunch of other things? Whereas, for example, let's go back to Tashkent today, and this is where you may correct me, right? This is your territory, not mine.
Hopefully, yeah.
But like, for example, if there is a strong, if you really privilege the patrilocal family, right? Then you want to get a daughter-in-law who is going to be well-behaved, good-natured, obedient, serve her in-laws, right? So and then you may try to exercise control over her so that she maintains the honor of the family.
Now, I wouldn't quite use the word honor.
Okay,
but like,
okay. What word would you use?
I don't know, like respect.
Respectability, right. Like respectability, right. Sorry. So you want to find a woman who people will not gossip about her. People will not spread rumors that she's up to no good, right? Yeah. So there are strong incentives to make sure that she's, you know, serving that family. Yeah. You know, and also there is, you know, strong pressures to have a son. You know, sons are celebrated. And so all those and you might still have a sort of a reverence for men as better leaders, etc. And so if the young woman can marry into a better family by signaling those norms of being well-behaved, then there is a strong incentive for young women to do precisely that. And so I was looking at some data today that shows in Uzbekistan over the past 10 years, more girls are being married under 18. And that could be because they're signaling, you know, this girl is not exposed to the wider world. She's still, you know, relatively young. Yeah. You know, she's malleable, right? She's going to be a good daughter because she's going to fit in and you can mold her as you like. So even if you expect her to go to work, you know, maybe you expect her to sell at the market in Tashkent or whatever, or something like that, even if she still comes back to that patrilocal family. And once you've had a couple of children, it's very difficult to rock the boat. It's very difficult to...
I mean, there are social costs for divorce.
Yes, huge social costs, right? Right?
Of course.
So even if you're working, no matter that work...
The work is really kind of weird. Like, I have my own theory, but and I'll tell you how I anecdotally collected data, if it is.
Yeah.
There's basically two sides of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So women who work are really women who don't have to work for money. So they do it for leisure, like a leisure class, like literally. So there are like government institutions that they pay very little. A lot of people who work there could be women. So, and then there's the other side of the spectrum where women work because they may not have breadwinners.
Yeah, desperation, or widows.
The household function, the production function, doesn't give enough. So the men work in a place where it's not sufficient to sort of support the family. And so it's like very two different spectrums. It's like a super rich woman who like drive cars and come to work to do like work for the social purposes. Especially it's like teaching at universities or stuff like that, where most of you're like everybody is aware. The women who work there do it for social reasons, not for economic reasons. And so what happens is there's a huge in-between between like 20th to like 90th percentile, where, you know, women can say, you know, I'm not that poor to work, or I'm not that rich to work.
Right. So wait, let me explain it in a different way. So if we go back to this honor income trade-off, but let's call it for Tashkent, the respect income trade-off,
let's,
right?
Let's put it this way. Respect. Because the honor has this connotation of like promiscuity, but it's not
okay,
the question
okay,
at all.
Respect income trade-off. Okay. So the poorest women have to work for bare bones survival.
Yeah.
So they sacrifice respect. You know, they're like, even if people are going to gossip about me being in that market.
But I don't have any choice.
I have no choice.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to do it.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
But what we see is in societies where family respect is contingent on a well-behaved woman, when the family gets a little bit wealthier, the woman withdraws from the labor market.
Right.
So they're basically buying, they're purchasing respectability. So in India too, in a rural area, as villagers get a bit richer, women stop working. Like a Dalit woman will stop working for the upper class because, you know, that, you know, why do it? Why forfeit all that social respectability? Okay? So, but then you have at the very higher, the upper echelon, you might have tertiary educated women who want to pursue their own fulfillment.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
But I don't think it's just leisure. I don't think it's just leisure. It's also respectability. So at government institutions, at higher educational institutions, you're mixing with a slightly different kind of people,
right? Yeah.
You expect greater respect. There's more surveillance. There's more norms of propriety. So no one is going to gossip or think badly about a woman who works at a university or a government job, right?
Yes.
There is no risk of impropriety.
Yeah.
There is no risk to the family's respectability.
Right.
So it's always this income respect trade-off.
I see what you mean.
So
yeah.
Let me give another example from Gaurav Chiplunko and Penelope Goldberg. They find that in India, a woman will work for a lower wage if it's for a female-owned firm, right? Because they're safeguarding her respectability.
The same thing in Uzbekistan, for sure, for sure. So there are works, there are types of jobs that women don't go because of the alleged inferences about that type of job that society may have.
What do you think that would be?
So like the job that requires mingling with men more.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, that would be
exactly mingling with men because that is damaging family respectability.
So the part of it is interesting though. Like even the high status jobs, like the government work, is high status, low pay. Or university, but they also mingle with men, but that doesn't have that.
But they have a different norms of propriety, different norms of respectability. So a guy who's been to university has been socialized in a certain kind of way, not to gawk at women.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, so like being forced to do jobs that forces women to hang around men, let's say, is obviously the least
the
favorite.
Bare bones survival.
Yeah.
Yes. You don't want to do that.
And
I think also what really matters is socialization. So there's this wonderful book Chup, which is about India.
What?
It's all, Chup. It means be quiet.
Chup.
Chup. And it really and it's all about Indian girls being socialized to submit, being socialized to put others first, to think about how to care for others, to think about how to take care of their grievances. So I remember I was in Rajasthan, I was interviewing this Jat woman, and I was asking her questions, like, what would you prefer, what would you rather, like, she in her community, women were not allowed to go to weddings. And I was like, well, would you like to go to weddings? And she just says, it's tradition. She didn't even have the frame of thinking of to say what she preferred. She didn't have, she just wasn't in that culture of picking and choosing and saying what she wanted. She just says, well, that's tradition. The idea of her having a subjective evaluation and saying what she wanted was not part of her, the way that she thought about the world. So I think if people are socialized to put others first, to, you know, women socialized to, you know, for example, in much of North India, men eat first, right? And that's totally unquestioned. In much of Southern India, you can have rates of 35% of people saying that a man is justified in beating his wife, right? Very high justification of men beating their wives. And that is because people are just, you know, adopt the norms of the environment. So you grow up in a place where violence is widespread, where men have the authority to act in these ways, then it's not necessarily questioned. You know, no person invents their own feminist treaties. Like I myself did not develop all the ideas that are in my head, right? I read hundreds and hundreds of books to get to this state. And if you're in an environment that's much more homogenous and patriarchal, you just don't question it, no matter if you work or not. You know, if you're just associating with other people who also have this patriarchal mindset, you know, in Russia,
Russian women work at very high rates. Russia has 44% of Russian economists are women. 44% of Russian business managers are women. But still, they see feminists as toxic, man-hating, aggressive lesbians. Right? And that's part, and I mean, that goes partly back to the question of authoritarian repression. If you're so repressive, then only the super, like, most radical people emerge, like Pussy Riot. So, you know, it's not a woman that you would identify with. But also, you know, you just don't have that culture, that visibility. And also, they've been tarred as Western, you know, feminists have been tarred as Western as a way of a sort of geopolitical.
Oh, yeah. I think Russia is a lot more liberal than its current government.
Yes, for sure.
Towards many issues.
Yes, for sure.
And I think, you know, once this generation dies out, which is now the Putin and his subordinates, like sort of the average Russian is a lot more,
yes,
I would say, liberal
in
a small L war than they want them to be perceived, or the current elite wants them to be perceived. So then the grand theory would be, if a country like, say, Uzbekistan,
yes,
is facing problems with gender disparities, I mean, my take, and I'm very biased, was that if our economy starts growing,
yes,
then women's rights gonna solve a lot of problems, gonna solve themselves.
Okay, so one...
Like, in this margin I was thinking, and you, I hope, will tell me why this is wrong.
Yeah. So I think, for example, it's certainly true that job-creating growth is a major engine of gender equality, mm-hmm, right?
So increasing wages, increasing demand for jobs.
Yes, definitely. Because, let's say, employers the world over prefer men. But if business is so profitable, it makes sense to hire more workers, then they're going to run out of men, and they hire women.
Yeah.
So women come to the front.
Or there's like a bigger fee to pay for bias.
You're right. If you're
woman-hating person, you're going to lose the business. Right?
I'll take it. Yeah. Right. Okay. But here's the... But I guess the question is that even as countries develop economically, you can still see different cultural influences. So perhaps we should talk about the religion in Uzbekistan, right? Okay. So the government used to be incredibly repressive.
Yeah.
You know, very, very repressive, you know.
Like women couldn't wear a veil and enter a government building, for example.
Or forcing, I think in Tajikistan, I read that in 2015, an official forced 15,000 men to shave their beards.
In Uzbekistan, they do this occasionally. They used to do it occasionally. I'm not sure the numbers in thousands,
but in Tajikistan, yes. So there are a bunch of very, very repressive practices.
That's right. Yeah.
And that pushes piety into the private sphere. So people may still be practicing their religion, but not doing it publicly. And
so the woman being part of private sphere.
Wait. But as governments liberalize in terms of permitting freedom of expression, then you may see more religion coming into the fore. And as long as people remain economically insecure, they may use that religion to back up the primacy of kinship. So I was going back to, you know, people wanting a well-behaved woman. You know, I've interviewed women from Uzbekistan who tell me that maybe the clerics will say, you know, a woman will only go to heaven if she pleases her husband. A woman will only go to heaven if she obeys her husband. If a woman obeys her husband, then it is not her sin. No matter what she does, it's not her sin. Now, that bit is not even in the Quran. But you have all these ideas that might be accepted because they reinforce the existing kinship system and obedience and serving to kin. So I certainly think that even as countries become wealthy, you can still see religion being used in a way to legitimize patriarchy.
But I was thinking, it is because of economic underdevelopment.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So my theory would go like this. I think you asked on Twitter a couple of years ago or a month ago, I lost track of time, that you said like, oh, I wonder what's happening in Central Asian countries about labor force participation and so forth. But my long answer was that because of lack of economic growth.
Yes.
This is the consequence of those.
Yes, right? So I would say, so economic growth affects maybe three domains. One is if you have low economic growth, then you have low demand for female labor. On top of that, kinship remains very, very important because you're so economically insecure. So you desperately need other people networks. To support you for mutual insurance.
You can't abandon your family, you cannot risk being so.
So if you're concerned about ostracism, you need everyone else's approval. So you need your wife to be doing something respectable.
On
top of that, there is a lot of literature that shows that if you have some negative shock, whether it is a health shock, whether it is an economic shock, you may turn to religion. So you may pray more, you may want the community of the mosque, etc. You may need, pray for a miracle, whatever. So as long as you have economic precarity, I think Uzbekistan's GDP per capita is like $1,500.
A bit more, but it's like 2,000.
Okay. So exactly. So as long as you have this economic precarity, you have low demand for female labor, women's stay.
And very high demand for being accepted in society.
Yes, exactly.
Because,
and then that interacts with the religiosity. Once some people turn religious, once you have a critical mass of religious people, then you need their approval. So you too start veiling.
And then what happened was that there's this repression of religion that happened is a catalysis for this, right?
I don't know whether it's the repression that caused it per se.
So let me tell you the story then, anecdotal. So I worked in they called Academy of Public Administration in Uzbekistan, 2015, before grad school in the U.S. So I come into the room, and then there is a woman who works for, like a state. She's like a young woman who works for the state, and she was presenting us something really bizarre. It was about how to catch a veiled woman if she's veiled in a bazaar, and what she was claiming that in the Western Uzbekistan, a lot of people don't wear. Headscarves, in a specific fashion. But if a woman is walking in a bazaar in a long-sleeved cloth or like a long skirt, it's likely that she's religious. And so police better watch out because she might be like, she might not be wearing a hijab in a traditional sense, but she could be doing it in Uzbek fashion. But because it's a long sleeve, it's a telltale sign that she is. Mm-hmm. She could be more religious than you think, so you have to go and like take note. So she was like talking about what she did in the region, in that academy. I walked down the corridor into my workspace, and a colleague of mine is crying. And I ask her what happened, and she's like, oh, some of the students complained to state security that her clothing was too promiscuous and they weren't able to focus. And so that day, I find out that basic question was that how long the skirt should be from the knee. Yeah. So she got repressed basically because her skirt was at the knee.
Yeah.
And that woman was arrested in the bazaar because it was too long. It was near the I don't know how to call it, like Achilles heel. Yeah. And it was like this 30 centimeters of woman's flesh. And if you like go too much up or down, then they're going to cause problems. Like they can fire you from there, or they can the police can go and not let you in metro. And so I was like, this is bizarre, but this is...
But I think that's an example of a range of things in totalitarian systems, which there are a range of weird things that happen, right, in totalitarian systems.
But what I think what this has caused is that the women who are discriminated against their religion now feel like if you don't do this, it's a bad sign because now you can do it. Like in Turkey, after Erdogan.
Yeah, I mean, I just think there are a bunch of motivations for religiosity, like going back to the economic shocks. I really like the work of Michel Gelfand and others, all about how when there's some kind of existential threat, a shock, you want your group to be strong, you seek a communal identity, you cling to the group, right? And religion is one way of bringing the group together. So just yesterday, I went to Friday prayers with my Somali friend, and that's a group activity, and praying or anything together, these synchronous ritual activities can promote a psychological effect of group bonding.
I see. Yeah. Okay. But, it's really hard to make conclusion out of it right now. So basically, like in the first scratch would be economic growth can improve women's lives.
Okay. I think that's too vague. I would say job creating economic growth tends to raise female labor force participation, right?
Which in turn...
But then you need the feminist activism. And the feminist activism can only take place in democratic cultures where there is a culture of resistance. So China has got much, much stronger economically. But there is still,
But compare China now to To
100 years ago, enormous
difference. No, not to 100 years ago. Like, let's say, to China 80s, in the 80s. Was it worse for women or better?
Okay, so I think one factor is you've seen massive urbanization. And so in cities, women can mix and mingle, share ideas, right? In rural areas, if you're just working on a family farm, then your exit options are terrible. You don't know alternatives. You're still in that patrilocal system.
But like for vast majority of Chinese
yes.
women.
Yes, so moving to cities, being more liberal, yes, that's an improvement. But you still have a very, even to Chinese government data, Chinese government data says that 35% of Chinese women have been beaten by their husbands. And that's government data.
Oh, wow. Okay. I see. Wow.
So I think it's important to recognize that things can improve, gender equality may improve in some domains, but not others. So, for example, you may see more women in the upper echelons of management. You know, Chinese, there are a lot of Chinese billionaires, female billionaires, but still locked out of politics, still impunity for male violence. So, and how that relates to welfare is a further question. So I think we see movements in lots of different domains.
So like economic growth can only help so far, basically. Like,
and I would say specifically it's about job creating economic growth because resource wealth won't necessarily have the same
effect. Oh, yeah, job creating, yeah. I mean, Uzbekistan doesn't have oil or anything that
But Kazakhstan obviously has spillovers from its oil.
Yeah. Kazakhstan has.
Yeah, and Kazakhstan, I think it shows up in the... So Kazakhstan, you know, and in more economically prosperous areas of Kazakhstan, you know, people tend to be more liberal. But I think that also comes back to culture, like we were talking about the Kazakh nomads. So I think Kazakhstan benefits from, one, a more gender-equal Turkic culture.
No, but like, you know, Turkmenistan is also a counterfactual in this.
Yes.
Turkmenistan is a lot worse for women.
And it's very, very poor.
No, Turkmenistan is not. It's not.
What's the GDP per capita?
So the problem is with the reporting.
Okay.
But I think it's not poorer than, say, Tajikistan. And then it's very kind of, the resources are constrained in around one family, basically.
Yes, yes.
But the situation with sort of women's rights is horrible. Like, they can't sit in the front seat of the car. Oh yeah, this is like ridiculous. Like they have specific set of haircuts they can get, and like they can't get like lashes or what. Like it's like absolutely bizarre if you just read their laws. It's like no place in former Soviet republics has it. But it's not particularly religious. It comes
It's from the government who said women can't sit in the front seat.
Yeah, if they're not married or something. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So like it's a quite repressive place for women.
Yeah.
And I would recommend you like interview Turkmen women in Turkey or something. Like
yes, I would
like to the stories are like absolutely like manicure would be a reason for getting fired from a job or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yes, it was very good in Turkey and in Poland. I was able to interview a lot of migrants, and that is why I like Toronto as well. I can meet lots of migrants.
Yeah.
My mother likes it too. She was like, "Better you stay in Toronto and interview people from Toronto."
Oh, your mother lives here.
No, but she's just happy that I'm in Toronto rather than going to Pakistan.
Okay.
But I will go to Pakistan.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need sort of some sort of boots in the ground, like to
actually see
stuff.
Yes, of course.
Because like reading is, I mean, it's
no,
great,
it makes
like,
a massive difference. Yeah. It makes a massive difference. So my mother will just have to endure.
Okay, I think the time allocated to me, I've spent most of it. So thank you so much for your time and willingness and you know, cooperation. Hopefully
we'll continue
our conversation.
Yes.
No, I mean, I didn't cover like even a third of it. Oh, there's one special question from one student.
Yes, yes.
So she asks... She asks why, so she's in Uzbekistan at the university, and she asks, like, she faces a lot more sort of, not discrimination, but let me see how she formulated it. God, I cannot find it. Anyway, it's too long of a list. So she says, like, her peers, female peers, are not happy with her ambitions, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so she feels that more females repress ambitions of their female peers rather than the males in the university.
So her female peers criticize her for being too ambitious?
More so than her male
peers?
But
I don't think we should be surprised by this. So when we talk about a culture, so earlier you used the term gender disparities, and I think that's the wrong term. I wouldn't use that.
Oh, okay.
I use the term patriarchy because patriarchy is a culture. It's about men being seen as better leaders, men being seen as more knowledgeable authorities, okay. men being deserving of deference. The idea is that women should serve men, right? So, and male activities, whether that's fighting or earning money, being culturally revered, while women are just these stupid idiots, whatever, right? So it's really about our mentalities. And within those cultures, it's perfectly normal and expected that anyone who's hearing those discourses, observing men in positions of leadership, would adopt those ideologies. So it's not like we should expect women to be especially gender equal. In fact, women can be incredibly...
Can they be more repressive?
Yes, of course. So the mother-in-law, right? I'm sure you've heard many stories in Tashkent of a very abusive, controlling mother-in-law.
For sure.
Because she wants to... So a woman in Tashkent... Her economic survival and future depends on her son as a breadwinner, right?
It's like a southern Italy.
Yes. But I think more so than that because, very strong parallel. So the worst thing for a woman in southern Italy or indeed Tashkent is if the bride and groom go and live separately because maybe he will be spending more on the wife. He will be giving more kindness and generosity. And then she's lost.
Yeah.
She's lost her breadwinner. She's lost her golden boy, right? So by controlling the wife, by keeping them all loyal to her, so there's this work by Anu Kriti and also Alison Evans in Uttar Pradesh and also in Odisha. They find that, married women have very few friends because they're so restricted by their mothers-in-law. And you can also see...
No, but why in an unmarried place where the university...
Okay. So you can have lots of jealousy. So one, you can also have jealousy between women, feeling uncomfortable. There's a very nice paper, I don't know if you saw it, on zero-sum mentalities. So in in communities...
It's an amazing paper,
nice. So where there is economic stagnation or massive discrimination, where it's very, very hard to get ahead economically, and when you have not experienced you getting ahead relative to your parents, then you may be very jealous of other people who do get ahead because you have this mentality, if they're getting ahead, it's worse for me. So it's that the pie is smaller and you feel uncomfortable. And so when I lived in a Zambian slum for 6 months, I really saw this, that people were not happy with their neighbors doing well. It really incited bitterness and disgust and hatred. Why is that person doing so well? You can also see it among academics today. They may be very jealous of someone else doing so well.
I mean, I saw it a lot in people who work for security apparatus because, there are so many generals they can give. So, any promotion is on their, on their dime. But there's one more question that one study is... Sorry, I had to ask you this. So there's a study at the University of Chicago School of Business in Booth. And the study, I'll tell you the design of the study, and I think you are familiar with it. So they interview women about their ambitions and careers. One-on-one, and then they ask women about their ambitions in front of the MBA class. You probably have...
I haven't seen this. Tell me.
It's an amazing paper. And what they find that women who are not engaged or not married or not dating tend to understate their ambition in front of the auditorium.
Really?
But in one-on-one, they will tell the truth. I mean, at least that's how the researchers are packaging it.
So they're selling themselves as not too ambitious.
But not women who are engaged, married, or having a long-term boyfriends. And that's happening at the university, it's an MBA program at the University of Chicago, one of the best business schools in the world. And I was like, wow, that's weird, but I don't know what's the explanation. What do you think?
It may be because those women believe that they don't want,
But are they right?
I don't know. In India, certainly, a woman...
But in the US.
But I just mentioned this one study. In India, a woman who mentions her job is less likely to get replies to a matrimonial advert. But whether that also holds in the U.S., I mean, you may, maybe women, I don't know. But maybe, yes, in the U.S., perhaps women imagine that if they signal too much ambition, then men will think that they're not so committed to the union. I don't know.
But the question that was lingering in my mind is that just the revealed preference of you pursuing grad degree at the Booth School of Business.
Yes, of course.
It's like super select to people who are very, very ambitious
yes,
from the get-go. And so it's like splitting hair, basically, at that level, where obviously you have worked in a very demanding job before getting into the MBA program. And obviously, if you are spending so much time and energy and money on this, you want some sort of payback. And everybody understands that, but even them, they're not so...
And that is why we need to use the term patriarchy, not gender disparity. Because that is patriarchy. That is women lowering themselves for public presentation.
The Economist question here is, we observe something and we say, is it optimal? So it's optimal if it's true for assertive mating. What if men don't care about it?
Yes, right. Then it's pluralistic ignorance, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yes, yes. So that's the thing I don't know. I mean,
but even I wouldn't use the term optimal even if men do care. I mean, because that's malleable, right?
No, yeah, for sure. But what I mean is like even at that cross section was like, what was it? Was it like, if you're a friend with that woman, would you say like, hey, by the way, just tone down your ambitions if you want to get married or something? Like, would you or not? Like, I'm not sure what's the policy angle here, you see? And that's why I'm like, you know, the fact that this happens in Uzbekistan, for example, is not surprising given it happens in the US.
This going back to your question on quotas, in the US case, it may be important and effective to have gender quotas because that might normalize people to ambitious women, right? So if you had more quotas in, for example, in management, for example, gender quotas in management, then people would become more accepting of female managers, realize they're widely accepted. So in those particular examples, you know, that could overcome if there is pluralistic preference.
All right, this was Alice Evans. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. For, great questions. Thank you.